Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Busy, busy program today. We have Jace LeCair, the 17-year-old who is a Vermont delegate to the Republican National Convention. We're going to be speaking with him in just a moment about his observations about the convention from a young person. And then Jeffrey Bartley, the executive director of Vermont GOP. He'll be calling in as well, again, on the Republican National Convention. And in the second hour, we'll talk with our friends at Talk Media News in Washington, D.C. about national politics and, of course, the Republican National Convention. Steve Terry will join us. He is the WCAX political analyst. And his topic, we're going to talk about the Vermont campaign finance reports. What did we learn in those reports about our gubernatorial candidates and about our lieutenant gubernatorial candidates? And then finally, Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine, will join us. Topic will be the Republican National Convention and his piece in Politico yesterday on U.S. Border Patrol and Donald Trump's decision to build a wall. So let's get this program rolling. And it's my pleasure to welcome Jace LeCair, the 17-year-old who is the Vermont delegate to the Republican National Convention. Good morning, Jace.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. Just before we get started about the convention, I'm just curious a little bit. You're 17 years old now. When did you become involved in politics?
Well, I think it really started for me back August when Rand Paul visited Vermont. You know, I got to meet him, hear his speech, and I think his message of liberty and limited government really inspired me to get involved in politics.
Why a Republican? I mean, most kids your age would not lean towards the Republican ticket.
Right. Well, I would consider myself a different kind of Republican. I'm more of a libertarian-leaning Republican. So there is some things that set me and a lot of other younger Republicans apart from our older Republicans.
And how did you get involved in seeking to be a delegate, and how did you get enough votes to be one?
Well, I got involved with Rand Paul's campaign, and then I was on Ted Cruz's after that. I wanted to keep involved with the process and give young people a voice at the convention. I worked fairly hard campaigning because I didn't have any name recognition. And I think the voters at the state convention really wanted to, you know, give younger people a voice, so they put me in.
So when you were campaigning for this, what did you say?
I basically, you know, said that the average age of the convention in Tampa 4 years ago was about 65 years old, and that, you know, the Republicans haven't won the youth vote in about, 50 years. So for me, I think they understood that, and I think that's why they wanted me to be a delegate.
And obviously that resonated among the Vermont convention, the state convention that you had. Can you just explain what goes on in being elected a delegate? Are people casting votes for particular delegates, and you had to ask each of those people to cast a vote for you? Is that how it went?
Right. So each town sends a number of state delegates to the state convention to elect the national delegates, and each of those delegates from the town get 13 votes, and there was about 40 people running, so you had to convince them to be in the top 13.
And how did you reach out to them? There must have been some sort of reach out before you actually got to the state convention.
Yeah, I sent out emails, you know, I did phone calls, So I reached out to them before. Also at the convention, I handed out flyers, you know, shook hands and talked to people.
Just curious, are you traveling by yourself to Cleveland?
I did travel here by myself, yeah.
Okay. So let's turn to the convention. The first day was rather exciting, I guess you could say, with the rules rebellion. Did you have knowledge that was coming to a head?
I was one of the ones that was a strong no vote on the rules. It was a power grab by the RNC, which teamed up with the Trump campaign. They rigged it a bit. They didn't do the roll call vote, and I thought that was disappointing to see.
And the roll call vote would have allowed other people to basically change the rules if they won the roll call vote. Is that right?
Right. Well, if we turn down the rules report, that would have made the rules committee have to go back in and meet again. Then there would probably be a compromise to give us some of what we wanted. And then we would have voted yes, and we would have been on with it.
So you were sympathetic to their cause?
I was very pro no vote. I was pretty involved with that movement.
So let me ask you this. And we're speaking with Jace LeCair, who is a 17-year-old Vermont delegate to the Republican National Convention. Let me ask you this. You're not a Trump supporter, so tell me, what reaction have you gotten or did you get before the convention, and have you received any adverse reaction once you got there?
Right, yeah. I haven't really been a big Trump supporter from the beginning. Certainly there's a lot of hardcore Trump fans that'll, give you their opinion, some nicer than others. I think I'll probably come around to maybe reluctantly voting for him in the general. But I did hear from a lot of people that were for Trump, and, I understood to, what they were saying. I just didn't agree with it fully.
And what is your day like? For example, what is your day like today? Is it filled with activities?
Well, right now, I just stepped out of a breakfast with Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa. After this, I'll be heading over to near the convention center, and I'll be doing interviews from 12 to 5. Then the convention's reconvenes again at 5:30.
And it'll go to what time at night usually?
It would depend, I guess. I think it went to about 11:30 last night.
Yesterday, who was the speaker that impressed you most?
The speaker that impressed me, I really like Sheriff Clark. I think he's good.
Rudy Giuliani
was the one that was, getting the biggest reaction. I think, everyone loves America's mayor, so.
Sheriff Clark's a Democrat, though.
Sure. No, Sheriff Clark's not a Democrat. You might be thinking of the lieutenant general that Trump was thinking of for a VP, yeah.
Okay. And so each day is filled with activities. Do you know what your agenda is going to be like?
It's pretty fluid. It changes. We do have a rough idea usually, but it can definitely change on the minute.
And when you say you're going to do interviews, what does that mean?
Radio, newspaper, TV. Around 12 today, I'll be going on Neil Cavuto's program, so that should be exciting. Then I'll have a couple radio interviews or something like that.
Great. And what do you hope to gain from your experience?
I hope to learn a lot. I'm learning a lot about, all sorts of things while I'm down here. Gaining experience, making connections with different people so, we can take that back home to help us there.
And the other thing that I was curious about, do you plan to run for political office in the future?
Yeah, I've always, been interested in the idea of running for public office. It's definitely something that's interesting to me. I look forward to seeing how it'll turn out, and I hope I get to do it.
And what sort of office would you think you'd be interested in?
I should probably start out small, I think. A state representative, maybe.
And where are you? you're going to be a senior next year at Colchester High, is that right?
Right. I'll be a senior next year.
Any immediate plans, college? What's your sort of game plan after high school?
I'm planning on going to the University of Vermont. I have talked about, running for state rep while I'm in college and see if I could make that work.
It works, by the way, Jace. I did the same. So
great to hear.
You can make that work when you want to. It takes you longer to get through college, by the way, just to give you a heads up.
All right.
Have you worked on a statewide campaign? You said you've worked on some of the presidential campaigns. Have you worked on a statewide campaign for a statewide GOP candidate?
I'm trying to stay out of the governor's race right now. That's getting a bit ugly, but I haven't yet. I'll probably be doing so when I get home.
And what's impressed you most thus far about your experience in Cleveland?
To me, I don't get to go to a big city that often. So, being in these big stadiums, seeing the big city, all the people that are here, it's really, exciting and new for me.
Would you like to see LeBron there as well with the Cleveland Cavaliers?
I haven't seen him yet. I'll look for him.
Now, the delegates that are going, that have gone to the convention, did you know them ahead of time? How's the interaction with the delegates? Do you get together on occasion during the convention?
Yeah, well, from Vermont, I knew most of the delegates. I have two friends here with me, Representative Paul Dame and Representative Jansen Wilhoit. I'm getting to know delegates from other states. We do, we get together, we talk, have meals together and that sort of thing.
And security, is it tight?
It is very tight, yeah.
Can you describe what you have to do to get into the stadium?
So we have to get on a bus. And to get on that bus, we have to check in with a Homeland Security agent. That bus then has to go through a number of checkpoints, and it goes down roads that are closed off and lined with fences. Then we have to go through, a couple more points of security, metal detectors, pat-downs, that sort of thing. And then to get on the actual convention floor, we have to go through even more checkpoints to actually get on the floor.
And what do you – I guess I'm just – as you look ahead on your agenda, who's the speaker other than the nominee? Who's the speaker you want to hear from most?
Well, Ted Cruz is speaking at the convention. I've been a fan of Ted Cruz, so I'm interested to see what he has to say.
Well, that is that will be interesting. And last night, there's big controversy, obviously, with Donald Trump's wife in terms of people claiming that she plagiarized parts of her speech with Michelle Obama. Was her speech well received at the convention?
It was well received. I haven't really. I heard that people were saying she might have plagiarized a little bit. I'm thinking maybe she didn't, and people are just thinking that because there's really only so much a wife can say about her husband running for president. So I think there might just be some similarities in them, but I don't think it is necessarily plagiarism.
And in your opinion, at 17 years old, what is the number one issue that Republicans need to run on this year?
Well, we actually have a Republican RNC Youth Caucus here, and the Youth Caucus voted the three most important issues that are important to younger people and millennials. Those three were the economy, abortion. My generation's actually more pro-life than the older generation, which is strange. You wouldn't really think that. And also, we want a more tolerant platform that's more inviting to, women and minority groups and other groups that the Republican Party doesn't usually win.
When you get done, Jace, what do you think is what do you envision would be a successful convention in your mind?
I mean, well, they already kind of spoiled that a bit with the with not allowing a roll call vote on the rules. I think, you know, I'm not sure how they can come back from that because there's still a lot of people that have, you know, their feelings are real hurt over that, and I think that might have deepened the divide a bit.
And given that, in your estimation, can Trump unite the party at the end of all of this?
I don't think he's going to completely unite the party, not nearly as much as Mitt Romney did. That doesn't mean he can't win, because I think he's bringing in a lot more Democrats and independents than Romney did. So we'll have to see how it turns out.
So what do you want to tell young Vermonters about the process and the Republican Party based upon your experience?
Right. Well, we definitely need all the help we can get from other younger voters. It's easy to get involved. I would say it's, you know, kind of fun, I guess. I encourage young people, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, to get involved, because I think it's really rewarding.
Jace, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Jace LeCaire, the 17-year-old who is a Vermont delegate to the Republican National Convention. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Just want to give you a preview of who's upcoming here on today's program. Jeff Bartley, the executive director of the Vermont GOP, will be joining us very, very shortly here. And in the second hour, Talk Media News will join us in about what's happening on national politics and, of course, the Republican National Convention. Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst, will join us, and we'll talk about what the candidates disclosed in their Vermont campaign finance reports for governor and lieutenant governor. And then we'll close out today with Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. We're going to be talking about, obviously, the Republican convention and his piece in Politico on U.S. Border Patrol and Donald Trump's plan to build a wall. But it's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Jeff Bartley, executive director of the Vermont GOP. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good. Just out of curiosity, Jeff, what's your role at the convention?
So my role is I'm a delegate aide, and so essentially any RNC-sponsored event, I do what I can to make sure things go smoothly for the Vermont delegation. That's mostly for when, obviously, they're in session or somebody needs to leave the floor, they have questions or anything along those lines. But obviously, while I'm here, I have my executive director's hat on as well and trying to fit in as many meetings as possible. So it's a pretty busy week.
Jeff, there was a floor rebellion yesterday that ultimately was quelled. Do you expect any more anti-Trump sort of maneuvering or moves at this convention?
I don't see much, and I think, honestly, that the notion of a rebellion is being a little overplayed in the media. I was on the floor when it happened. It was very clear that, you know, there was a vocal minority that wanted to have a roll call votes on various different things so they could be on record, but they weren't able to get enough signatures from the states, not enough states to participate in this effort to change the rules, and so it ultimately wasn't even really brought up for a vote. So, I don't think there's going to be much of anything more. You never know, but it's going to be an exciting week for sure.
When this action took place yesterday, there were 9 states that were involved, and then 3 dropped out, and there were 6 states. You need 7 states in order to have a roll call vote. If what I was reading is correct, what made those other states change their mind?
I've heard a couple of different reasons why they did. A lot of it was centered around something called, it was a petition. I never personally saw it. I don't know the language, so I'm reporting that what I heard from other people. But some states were signing something they didn't fully understand. And then also they required the majority of delegates in order for a state to sign a petition or go down this path, and some of them didn't even have enough. So here in Vermont, there were three members of the Vermont delegation who signed the petition. Obviously, we have 16 delegates, so they really would have had to get nine to sign in order to be part of that. And so the states didn't get that. It wasn't that they necessarily dropped out. It was one dropped out, and I think it was three that were disqualified because they didn't have the required signatures. So this movement had three opportunities, and they failed on each juncture. So, we moved on, and we'll see what happens in the next couple of days. But I really don't think it's going to be a lingering effect going forward.
You mentioned that we have 16 delegates. How many are Trump supporters, and how many support others? And can you just explain, are they bound to support the primary results here in Vermont on the first ballot?
So the Trumps, we have eight Kasich delegates and eight Trump delegates. Now, I don't have a whip count of who is going to be voting for Trump or the others. Trump, those delegates are bound on the first ballot. The eight Kasich delegates, if he was nominated and he had not suspended his campaign, they would still be bound. But because they are not, they're essentially free agents, and so they will be able to vote for who they choose. I'm certain some of those will vote for Trump, and others might vote for other people.
One of the there are many Vermonters who have prestigious positions at this convention, Susie Hudson being one of them. She was into the limelight yesterday during this sort of anti-Trump maneuver because they had to deliver the petitions to her and they had to find her. Besides Susie Hudson, any other sort of prestigious positions Vermonters are holding at the conventions?
That Susie is really the big one. In our delegation, we have every state delegation or, the islands and so forth, all have two members, one male, one female, on the Credentials Committee, the Rules Committee, and the Platform Committee. So there are various people who are involved in different things. But I would say tonight, I don't know what the local TV stations, if they're covering anything of the convention, our National Committee Man, Jay Shepard, is actually going to be speaking. So that's pretty exciting.
And in your estimation, what does Trump have to do to unite the delegates coming out of this convention?
My estimate, that's a loaded question. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of burned bridges that we need to build in the party. And I think that he's got to come out with a strong agenda that people can get behind. I think the rhetoric, I can say, as a Vermont Republican, the rhetoric is it needs some work. And I think, as we go forward, it's still very early in the campaign, and he has those conversations. He's got to build those relationships. But I would also say that it's important for Republicans up and down the ticket and then across the states to not bucket just a bucket. And there's definitely a taste out there of dissatisfaction with, some of the big wigs like Jeb Bush and so forth that are purposely, snuffing the convention. And I think that also creates hard feelings. So it's not just that Trump needs to do X, Y, and Z. I think we all need to and realize that, Trump is the nominee. He will be a much better president than Hillary Clinton by far. And we need to focus on that.
I was surprised yesterday, Jeff, it would be interesting to get your reaction, that Trump's campaign chair, Paul Manafort, went after Kasich, calling him petulant, and said the governor was embarrassing his own party in his home state for not showing up at the convention. Does that help at all?
Absolutely not. I mean, what's the Reagan 11th commandment? Thou shalt speak ill of, fellow Republicans. I think, all across, every state goes through this. We certainly had some, struggles in Vermont as well. Is if you want to move forward, you have to move forward as one. And so the language cannot be incendiary. And again, we need to focus on what's in front of us if we are not successful this November. And so I would encourage everybody to make sure we're taking that approach.
We're speaking with Jeff Bartley, who's the executive director of the Vermont GOP. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Jeff, I was surprised last night, that Trump himself sort of trampled all over the emotional testimony of Patricia Smith because he went on Fox, the O'Reilly Factor, Bill O'Reilly show, at the same time that Patricia Smith was, you know, holding back tears, I guess, and on the stage, and really had I thought the audience really captured in what she was saying about her son being killed in Benghazi. That coupled with sort of going after Kasich yesterday, how is this being managed from the Trump organization? Is it heavily managed or is it just on the fly?
You know, I honestly don't know. I mean, I was obviously in the convention and did hear the speakers. And I'm not intimately involved with the Trump campaign by any stretch of the imagination. So I don't know what the strategy was behind it. I can tell you that this speaker, it was very emotional, very powerful. And so those who did see it and paid attention to, you know, the convention or watching the convention rather than flipping it to another channel, I think definitely heard the message.
Who was the best speaker last night?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. You know, I'm a big fan of Rudy Giuliani. I always have been. You know, it was in high school when 9/11 happened, and obviously followed him very closely through that ordeal. And I was a fan of his in the 2008 election. So seeing him speak, I've met him a couple of times, but I thought it was very. Very energetic speech. It was kind of funny. I was on the bus coming back, and you know, mixed responses to it. And some one person commented, "Like, well, it seemed like it was a little Howard Dean." But being in the room, I mean, it might be different on TV. It was very energetic. Several standing applauses. And I think that was by far the more riveting speech of the evening.
What do you hope to gain from this experience?
You know, I'm here. I got my head down to get work done so that, you know, Vermont Republicans can be successful this November. Obviously, I want to make sure the delegation has a great time and things run smoothly. I think it's an opportunity to network with my fellow executive directors across the country to, you know, get some, you know, tips and tricks and so forth. But right now, it's just making sure everything runs smoothly.
And besides the nominee, who are you looking forward to hearing at the convention?
Well, Giuliani was the one I was really excited about. I'm actually really looking forward to seeing Speaker Ryan speak. And I'm actually unclear when he's going to be there today or tomorrow. He's on the agenda for various different things, but I don't know if there's engagements. So you know, that's who I'm looking forward to. He's obviously a heavyweight in our party. And he's just an all-around, you know, strong policy advocate. He's a great Speaker of the House, so I think that's going to be exciting for me personally.
On a typical day, what did the delegates do? I mean, they start out early. We just heard from Jace, who was starting out very, very early. But on a typical, and he's obviously got some media that he's going to do this year, this week, because I think they're looking at a 17-year-old and saying, "We want to talk to you." But what do the other delegates do on a typical day?
You know, it really varies on interest. I mean, today there's a lot of downtime. Every morning we have a delegation breakfast. Yesterday we were actually just next door from our hotel, and we had Tim Griffin, the lieutenant governor from Arkansas, came to speak. Today we actually were with the New Hampshire GOP, Delaware, Rhode Island, a few other states. And we had Jody Ernst and a congressman from Pennsylvania. His name's escaping me right now. And tomorrow we're actually having breakfast with Rudy Giuliani. So I'm pretty pumped about that, obviously. And then from there, it depends when the convention is in session. Today it doesn't start till 5:30, so we'll, you know, head over there around probably 3 o'clock. So there's probably a lot of sightseeing. There's a lot of networking events, parties, and concerts. And so it's you know, there's a lot of business work to get done. It's also kind of a celebration of the Vermont delegation and being Republicans.
What will make the convention successful from your point of view?
As long as things continue to go smoothly.
Let's start turning to Vermont politics, and I'll just ask one question, then we got to go to a break. But Phil Scott doesn't support Donald Trump. Bruce Lissman hasn't decided whether he's going to support Donald Trump or not. Does that hurt the Vermont delegation in any way?
I don't think so. We all know Vermont Republicans are very independent in nature, much more moderate. And our two governor candidates are the best governor candidates that are in the race by far. And they're really echoing, I think, a sentiment in Vermont that, you know, it's not going to go to Trump. It's definitely a blue state when it comes to the electoral. But it's about your approach and your demeanor. So it doesn't surprise me. I don't think it hurts the Vermont delegation. I mean, obviously, Susie Hudson's the secretary of the Republican National Committee and convention. So I just don't see it as having an impact at all.
Jeff, what will be the number one issue that Republicans need to run on this year on a national basis? What will come out of the convention as the number one issue?
Well, it's a big theme today is jobs, the economy. People are really struggling. We're seeing average incomes across all demographics have been plummeting. The taxes are skyrocketing. The budget's not helping us. And I think right now you can feel it in the air here at the convention. There is a big security concern all across the board. And so I think it's going to be a combination of the security questions, but the jobs in the economy by far is number one.
I asked Jace this same question. Be interested in your take as well. Is security tight there?
Very, extremely tight.
And can you explain what you have to go through each day?
Yeah, I mean, we get on a bus. You have an escort. You have to check in with Homeland Security and or Secret Service. There is a perimeter around the queue or the Quicken Loans Arena where the convention is. So I hope you don't work or live in there because it's very difficult to get in and out. You have to have credentials. If you lose your credentials, you might as well drive home. You won't be allowed anywhere near the convention site. It was a little eerie. I picked up a couple delegates at the airport on Sunday and seeing military helicopters flying around. Obviously things are there's a lot going on around the world, and so that's definitely adding to the tension. But I do feel really safe. I think they've done a great job executing it. Cleveland has been an amazing city, and I was kidding with somebody. This actually shows a good Republicans and Democrats can work together because the Cleveland mayor is a Democrat, and he's been phenomenal in making sure that this goes off smoothly.
Any outside protests that you've seen?
I haven't, but I haven't been in that area. I know some of our delegation have gone to check it out, and I've seen some pictures on social media and so forth, but I haven't personally seen it.
We're speaking with Jeff Bartley, Executive Director of the Vermont GOP. Obviously, he's at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland right now. When we come back with Jeff, I want to turn to Vermont politics. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Jeff Bartley, who's the executive director of the Vermont GOP. If you wish to join our conversation, you have a comment, concern, question, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Jeff, I want to go to a phone call here. Let's go to Jim in Barrie. Jim, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mike. Good morning to your guests. I just wanted to do a shout out to Jim Douglas's Young Guns. I really was disinterested in the convention this year. I've just been kind of just disgusted by the whole thing. I had it on last night just briefly. Susie came to the podium, and I just kind of welled up with pride and said, I remember her when Jim Douglas's first campaign, and she was up. We were up over the Capitol Plaza's old offices up there. And Jim Barnett, national spotlight as well. And, of course, Neil Lundville, you know these people all well, I'm sure, Mike. But anyway, I think if the future of the Vermont Republican Party rests with these people and in the image of Jim Douglas, I think we're all in good shape in the future.
Thanks, Jim. That's Jim from Barrie. Thank you, Jim, for your phone call. Jeff, what do you say about Jim's comment?
I think she's spot on. You know, I'm a little biased because Susie Hudson is one of my best friends. But it's pretty amazing to see. We're a small state. We don't get a lot of attention when it comes to the national politics, you know, the national races. But to still see our state being able to contribute at such an integral level, she's involved in a lot of meetings. She, unfortunately, has not been able to spend a lot of time with the delegation because she's bouncing from meeting to meeting or making sure things run smoothly and legally compliant. And so I was personally, I mean, she's a very good friend of mine. I was very, very happy and proud to see her on stage. And she'll be there today. She's doing the roll call vote. I think it's the vice presidential nomination that we're doing today. And so she's calling off the states. And that's just, it's pretty amazing.
I got to sit here and chuckle a little bit. Jim didn't include me in the young guns with the Douglas administration. I must be an old gun.
I noticed that, too, but I didn't want to say it.
Hey, turning to Vermont, what is the role of the Vermont GOP?
We are focused on getting Vermont Republicans elected. You know, we obviously have competitive governor's race that we think we will be successful this year with. And we're focusing on to provide balance.
Yeah, we're losing you a little bit, Jeff. If you could sort of move a step right or a step left, there we go. We got you back.
How's that?
That is.
Sorry about that.
No, that is fine. How do you support candidates then?
You know, we provide the infrastructure, technology, data, trainings, and then obviously a grassroots network. Across the state, we have staff that we're hiring for the upcoming election, and so we're working closely with our local candidates and helping them with their campaigns. So that's the strong focus of my job and many at the VTGOP.
And when you have a primary, you basically keep out of it. How does that work?
Basically, I keep my mouth quiet. you know, we allow the candidates to run a race. We'd like it to be, you know, energetic, vigorous, and on the issues to promote not just the candidates individually, but the Republican Party altogether. And so when the dominoes fall, and the votes are cast come August 10th, you know, we're ready to go with our nominee. And we only have two primaries in the state, or excuse me, we have three. In the state this year, so thankfully there's not too many. We definitely don't have any issues with primaries, but we're ready to go. And getting the infrastructure in place now is vital. And on August 10th, actually, we're having a UD breakfast in the Capitol Plaza at 9 a.m. so the party can come together and hands can shake and we can move forward.
In the primary for governor, it seems like there's a lot of activity on the Republican side. In fact, a lot of mailings, a lot of commercials, trying to depict Phil Scott as Peter Shumlin's wingman. Is that accurate depiction of Phil Scott?
That's certainly what Bruce Lissman's take is. And so, you know, they're entitled to run against one another. I just hope that, you know, we don't get too far in the negative weeds. But so far, I think it's been okay. And so we'll see how August shakes out. But, you know, we're really not in the position where we're going to talk to one candidate or the other, you know, on their ads or so forth. We just hope that it's a positive issue-based campaign.
What will be the issues come November?
Jobs, the economy, and affordability. And I have to say, I'm trying to pay attention to the news while I'm out here in Cleveland, and sometimes that's tough. But I saw that you know, Sue Minter came out and said that her number one focus is gun control, and it just shows how out of touch the Vermont Democrats are if they think that's what the number one issue facing Vermonters is. So, you know, we're very excited to run on a message of balancing Montpelier, of bringing affordability. The cost of living in Vermont is atrocious, and it's getting worse. And job creation, you know, about respecting job creators and rewarding them for creating jobs and partnering and trying to find new ways to encourage business growth in Vermont. That's what Republicans are going to be running on this November.
As you look at the campaign finance reports, it looks like – this is going to be in uncharted territory in terms of the amount of money that's going to go into the governor's race. It looks like it's going to be a governor's race that will cost somewhere in the range of $2 million. How do you help a candidate raise money?
Well, right now, obviously, we're completely staying out of it in the governor's race. They have to defend for themselves, so to speak. But afterwards, you know, if we... we're going to try to fundraise to pay for our infrastructure and our get out the vote efforts and assist the governor nominee in any way we can. It's going to be an expensive race, but I do want to point out, looking at Matt Dunn's campaign finance filings, for example, 60% of his campaign contributions came from outside of the state of Vermont. So the question is, yes, it's a more expensive race, but who are we really trying to represent here? And I think our governor candidates, Bruce Lissman and Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, have done a great job reaching out and talking to Vermonters and not holding out, out-of-state fundraisers like Matt Dunn is doing on July 20th in New Hampshire.
Of course, Bruce Lissman's campaign is mostly self-funded, so he doesn't have to go outside the state. Is money going to be important in this upcoming election, or is it going to be the issues?
Well, it's the issues by far, because those guide a lot of things. The issues are on the side of the Republicans. We at the party, we are seeing the amount of donors year over year is skyrocketing. We're feeling very successful on that front. But it's about taking the message locally, and you cannot replace door-to-door contact with voters. You cannot replace phone calls. You cannot replace House candidates speaking with individual voters on a daily basis with, large, media ads that are paid for by out-of-state donors. So that's what we're focused on in the Vermont Republican Party. Our funds are purely in grassroots data and get out the vote, and we're ready to rock and roll. We're going to be successful this November.
We're speaking with Jeff Bartley, Executive Director of the Vermont GOP. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Tom, I'm going to take one phone call here. Let's go to Justin in Randolph. Justin, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I don't want to take away from the current speaker right now that you have on, but I just want to comment on your earlier speaker, the 17-year-old. I'm going to call him a kid because he is a kid. He was awesome. And to listen to that gentleman, he sounds like he's a well-seasoned political veteran that has excellent speaking abilities. And I'm a little frustrated with our youth nowadays. Sometimes you don't see the involvement that they should have, but that kid just floored me. And kudos to him. He's just great. And that's all I got to say.
Thanks, Justin, for your phone call. He was pretty good. I gave him some advice, Jeff, was that you can go to college and run for the legislature at the same time. Some of us have done it before. So it will take longer to go through college. I warned him about that.
Yeah, I'll make sure he's at the top of my recruitment list for 2018. If I could add, though, to what the caller, I think it was Justin, said, Jace, he is young. I know he's really put himself out there. He's got interviews left and right. He's, our understanding, is one of, if not the youngest delegate. But what's impressed me the most about him is he has taken a lot of heat nationally. There's been some negative articles and comments about him. And for a 17-year-old, from Vermont, who I did hear part of the interview, he said, "Hey, I'm in a big city. That doesn't happen a lot." He's holding his head up high. And I think it really shows that, Vermont, that millennials are really taking a look at the party, and we'd love to have people involved like Jace at such a young age, and he's really doing Vermont proud.
Why should Vermonters vote Republican?
Because in Vermont, many different reasons. But, take a look at the last 6 years. We've had one-party rule, and you cannot say that your life is better or any easier. Or it's easier to pay your bills. $300 million in new taxes since 2011 is that's a lot of money for Vermonters and on Vermont businesses. So if we don't balance Montpelier, it's only going to get worse. You're going to see an 89 cents per gallon tax on your gas and home heating fuels. We're going to start seeing Democrats are going to focus on issues like gun regulation rather than trying to adjust the address the cost of living or property taxes. I'm 30 years old. I live in Colchester. I'm on my local board. I'm active in my community, but I can't afford to buy a house in Vermont. It's just too expensive. The property taxes are keeping me out of the market. So voting for Vermont Republicans, balancing Montpelier, providing more common sense solution in the House especially is sorely needed this election cycle.
Jeff, in 30 seconds, what do you hope comes out of this convention?
I would like to start seeing some unity. I would like to see the rhetoric toned down so that it's easier for Republicans in states like Vermont to be behind our nominee. But I'm really hoping that Vermont Republicans leave here proud. As Jim from Barry pointed out, we're doing a lot of good work for you here, but and I hope that energizes you. So come November, we can elect a Republican governor, elect Randy Brock to lieutenant governor, pick up more seats in the House and Senate.
Jeff, thank you very much for your time. I know you're busy. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Jeff Bartley, who's the executive director of the Vermont GOP. Also, I want to thank our first guest today, which was an amazing guest. 17-year-old Jace LeCaire of Colchester, who is a Vermont delegate to the Republican National Committee convention as well. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then we'll speak with Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst, and Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio, celebrating the future with our 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Barrie. No, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. It's Tuesday. I can hardly speak. This is Mike Smith. Be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We turn our attention to national issues right now, particularly the Republican National Convention. And on the line is Ellen Ratner. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning from the great state of Ohio and the best location in the nation. Now, I know you guys might have some problems with that, but that is how I feel.
You're from there, right?
I am from Cleveland, Ohio, and I want you to know the governor came to my party last night, even though he did not come to the convention.
And I was going to start off with that, actually. What sense does it make picking a fight with the governor on the first day of the convention when Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort called Kasich, the governor of Ohio, petulant, and that the governor was...
He should have never called the governor of our great state that. First of all, the reason I honestly think that that Governor Kasich isn't coming here is not just his issues with Donald Trump. He's got a 70% positive rating in Ohio. That means a lot of Democrats like him.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the middle voter likes him.
So given what's happening on the first day, what's your take on the first day, first night of the Republican National Convention?
Well, our take is that, and I think it's everybody's take, it's not just mine, is that it went very, very well, and that protests are at an absolute minimum. I've seen them at every single convention, and I'm not surprised. And frankly, everybody's making a big deal about Donald Trump's wife stealing things from the speech of Michelle Obama in 2008. But you know what? She probably watched a lot of speeches. She's probably taking what she considers the best. They have a very different view of plagiarism in Africa. My guess is they have that in Europe as well. And so what?
Yeah, I was a little surprised, Ellen, that it's being blown up the way that it is, because the phrases that she used, work hard, those sort of things, are fairly common phrases.
That's right. Look, I'm a liberal, lefty, loony Democrat. And I honestly, I have to call it as I see it, and I just don't see this was a very big issue. And I think she'd make a fine first lady. I mean, really.
What about the revolt yesterday?
Went absolutely nowhere, the revolt yesterday.
And the it didn't seem It almost seemed like a disorganized revolt at some point.
Well, it wasn't all that disorganized. It just didn't have much impact.
One of the things, Ellen, as I sort of was watching this, I was surprised about the choreography of the first day, in that you had the mother of one of the four Americans killed in Benghazi on the floor, Patricia Smith, speaking, and then the candidate himself goes on, Bill O'Reilly. Doesn't he sort of take away from that what I think they wanted to show was the emotional impact of that death
well,
of her son?
Well, they did, but that was not his priority, and it might have been Bill O'Reilly's for a brief period of time, but then when he got Trump on, it changed.
One of the things that was said during yesterday was a former underwear model, Antonio Sabato, talked about that President Obama is absolutely a Muslim. I don't believe the guy is a Christian. I don't believe he follows the God that I love and the Jesus that I love. Is that a way to be sort of bringing people together?
Well, no. But, you know, this is all about electoral votes and who you're going to get. And every speech, everything that everybody says is designed to either get people out of their houses to vote, it's designed to speak to a very specific demographic, and you can expect that at both conventions.
We've spoken to two delegates or two people from Vermont today, and they sort of give thumbs up to Rudy Giuliani's speech. What did you think of it?
Everybody was very impressed with Mayor Giuliani's speech, and don't forget, he was there at 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So he has the, you know, the backing to say what he did.
And according to the Washington Post, Chris Christie is peeved he didn't get the vice presidential nod. Is that something you're hearing?
Well, you know, again, he picked who he had to pick. I yesterday talked to one of his generals who's doing a lot of his work, and he seemed perfectly rational and reasonable. I think that there is again, this is all about electoral votes. It's all about getting people out of the houses. So the vice presidential pick of Donald Trump was for that reason.
Given we've only seen one day, but just if it keeps going the way it is, Ellen, does Donald Trump get a bounce out of the Republican convention?
Yes, of course he does. And he gets a bounce in the great state of Ohio, which is very important to him.
And anything else you want to add?
Well, the only other thing is, of course, who's going to be speaking tonight. We're going to be hearing from Shelley Moore Capito. And as you know, she is the senator from West Virginia. We're going to be hearing from Mitch McConnell, who's the majority leader. We're going to be hearing from the Speaker of the House. We're going to be hearing from one of Donald Trump's sons tonight. And we're going to be hearing from Mike Mukasey, who was the attorney general under Bush 43.
Any backlash that the Bushes aren't there?
You know, there may be, but we're not hearing anything. People are just focused on today because maybe people have lousy memories.
Ellen Ratner, as always, thank you so
much.
Thank
you.
That's Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News. Coming up, Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, Mike. Good morning.
We're going to talk about the Vermont campaign finance reports that came out on Friday. Turning to the Republicans first, just to give an update in terms of what those figures were. Bruce Lissman, he's had $1.2 million contributions since March. Most of that is his own money. Total contributions, again, $1.8. Most of it is his own money. Total spent, $1.6 million. Cash left, $185,000. Phil Scott, contributions since March, $349,000. Total contributions, $859,000. Total spent, $466,000. Cash left, $370,000. The Republicans, what's your take on what you're seeing?
Well, number one, the headline is we will see Bruce Lissman probably spending more by the August 9th primary. He may be close to $2 million by then. That'll be the most expensive race we have ever had for governor in Vermont. But this is only the primary. It also tells me that Phil Scott has been raising money, but he does not seem to be overly concerned about the Lisman challenge, and he is keeping a lot of dry powder for the general election.
So let me ask you this, Steve. Is Lisman's money being well spent right now?
Well, it's hard to say. I bet we know that he started absolutely with very low name recognition. I would expect that his ads has certainly increased that. He is probably a lot closer to Phil Scott than he was when he started. So from that perspective, but I know sources say that he thinks he might end up within, or is right at the moment, within 15 points of Phil Scott, but that seems to be overly optimistic from my perspective.
Phil Scott, on the other hand, my takeaway here, he's got a pretty high burn rate for somebody that's not up on TV, so I would suspect he's focused on get out the vote efforts as I look at his burn rate. What's your take on Phil
Scott? Oh, there is no question at all that all of the candidates are certainly handicapped by the hideous fact that we're having an election on August 9th, and that is where the get out the vote effort is really, really important. So I think both Lisman and Phil Scott are investing a lot in that, and they're all being incredibly hopeful that they can stimulate people to actually vote.
Let's turn to the Democrats, and I'll give the figures here. Peter Galbraith, there's four actually Democrats, but I'll give the four. Peter Galbraith, he's had contributions since March of 328,000, total contributions of 328 because he started late. Total spent 287, cash left about 41 grand. Matt Dunn, since March, 252,000 he's raised, total contributions 819,000, total spend 611,000, cash left about $208,000. Sue Minter, Democrat, contribution since March, 405,000. Total contributions 893,000. Total spend 596,000. Cash left 296,000. And then Brooke Page, a Democrat, contribution since March 5,245. Total contributions 5,245. What's your take on the Democrats?
Well, obviously the big news and the headline out of that is that Sue Minter appears to be coming on strong as the election day grows near. I think there were some people who were even predicting that her overall money raise may be almost closer to $1 million because of her absolute, it seems, national strength with Emily's List, which, as we know, promotes Democratic women candidates. That said, and she does have a good nest egg for the last few weeks. I understand that she'll have another ad up on the air tomorrow, and that means, of course, a portion of the money will go to that. But it is still, in the end of the day, the ground game and that getting out the vote. Now, on that score, we have to look at the fact that union endorsements are much more on the Matt Dunn side. He had one yesterday from the professional firefighters, which, by the way, historically, or not historically, in the last open races, they have supported Republicans. And as a matter of fact, I think they supported Phil Scott in 2014. So union help in getting out the vote is a very important factor for Democrats. So I think the question is, and my view is the race is still a toss-up, with perhaps Minter starting to get a little more momentum, but at the end of the day, of course, it's who votes.
One of the things that surprised me, and you mentioned it at the top of the interview, was the fact that this is going to be a $2 million gubernatorial race, no matter how you look at it. The Democrats are going to spend $1 million in the primary. The Republicans will have to spend another $1 million in the general election. This is a $2 million race, and this is almost unheard of in Vermont.
No question at all, and this is a race, Mike, I know from your perspective, you will probably see the Republican Governors Association to be quite strong in helping whoever the Republican nominee is, probably Phil Scott, to raise and be very competitive for the November general election.
As well as the DGA as well. The Democratic Governors
Right.
Association will be very heavily involved if this is anything close in,
no
in,
question.
In an election. Any themes emerging that we will see in the general election and the gubernatorial race in terms
of
issues?
Well, I think we will see whoever the Democratic candidate is, I think they will be much stronger still on the social issues than obviously the Republican nominee. But I think both of them are going to have to get much more or will be focused on Vermont's economic future. And at the end of the day, jobs, housing, property taxes will be the issue that's on a lot of voters' minds in Vermont.
Steve, quickly, turning to the Lieutenant Governor's race, obviously Randy Brock doesn't have a primary, and he's raised, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think it was $65,000.
Right.
The Democrats, what are you seeing on that side where you have a three-way race?
Well, I think that Shep Smith is doing well on the money raising, but you know, I was a little surprised to see even Keisha Rahm actually did better than I thought. At the end of the day, I think that race will turn on what the voter turnout in Chittenden County is, and that may well be the deciding factor.
And who's that favor if it does?
Well, I just based on the signs I see, Zuckerman seems to be having more lawn signs than I have seen in the other candidates. But that said, most legislative Democrats are working very hard to elect Shep Smith, and they are obviously talking to their friends and constituents about that issue. So I think at the end of the day, I think Shep may run a little stronger.
Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. And coming up, Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. And we're going to be talking about the Republican National Convention and his piece he wrote yesterday in Politico magazine on the U.S. Border Patrol and Donald Trump's wall. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. And good morning, Garrett.
Good morning.
Have wanted to start off with the convention, and then I want to start off. You made me read 22 pages of your article the other day. I want to get to that article that's entitled Donald Trump's Army on the Border. Wanted to start off with the convention, though. What will make this convention successful for the Republicans?
So the short answer is Donald Trump needs to spend this week convincing 6 million people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 that they should either stay home or vote for Trump. That's the margin of difference in round numbers that Donald Trump needs to turn in order to be victorious this fall. And I think the challenge is last night was not a good start to that. It was a night spent entirely shoring up Donald Trump's base and shoring up the Republican base. And I don't think a lot of people who were on board, who are not on board with the Trump campaign, saw a lot to like last night.
Mm-hmm. And for his part, and you're talking about this, will he be able to unite the party coming out on Friday?
All signs from yesterday point to no. You saw a very spontaneous an unexpected rebellion on the convention floor yesterday over whether delegates will have to vote for Donald Trump, and that left some bad taste in people's mouths. The Colorado delegation actually stormed out of the hall at one point, Colorado being a key battleground state that Donald Trump almost absolutely has to win if he's to get to 270 electoral votes in November.
Does Pence help? Mike Pence, who is the VP pick?
Mike Pence doesn't hurt Donald Trump. He is a solid conservative. He's an establishment Republican. He is a family values Republican coming from a solidly red state. But again, I don't necessarily know that there are a lot of Obama voters who look at Mike Pence and say, yeah, I think that helps me support Donald Trump. And remember, that's the key. It's not at all about whether Donald Trump can win the 60 million votes that Mitt Romney won in 2012, which actually right now looks like it's going to be a challenging math problem even to get to that mark. It's whether he can get to this roughly 65 million, 66 million votes that Barack Obama won in 2012.
So last night, as you're looking at this, who was the most effective speaker to help him bring those votes? Because I'm going to talk to about Hillary Clinton, because she's got a challenge as well in a moment. But who was the most effective speaker to help him bring those votes?
Well, so the challenge is, if you had asked anyone at the exact end of the convention last night, at 10:30 when Melania Trump left the stage, everyone would have said Melania Trump did a wonderful job, that she knocked it out of the park last night. Well, by this morning, we see that roughly two paragraphs of her speech were plagiarized almost directly from Michelle Obama's speech to the 2008 Democratic Convention. That's a terrible catastrophe for the Republican Party for two reasons. One, it's an embarrassment, and it's something that the party that undermines some of the messages that the party was trying to send last night. But number two is, and you and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago with Donald Trump's last big controversy over his Star of David anti-Semitic tweet with Hillary Clinton. Well, the way that Donald Trump runs his campaign, what should have been a quick blip of a scandal, and a speech writer should have been fired at 7 a.m. this morning, and everyone move on with their day, the Donald Trump campaign's tendency is to dig in and make these controversies last longer. And that's what you're already beginning to see this morning, is people like Paul Manafort, the campaign executive, or Chris Christie out there denying that anything, any plagiarism actually took place. And that's just going to make this story go longer and continue to dominate the coming days.
One of the things I was curious about, Garrett, was that Paul Manafort decided to take on Kasich at the start of the convention. What was up with that sort of thinking?
Well, this is, I think, the Donald Trump scorched earth political philosophy, where he is really enjoying continuing as the nominee to punch down at his former rivals. And really, as you point out, the decision by Paul Manafort to go after the home state Republican governor in a key battleground state on the first day of the Republican convention is inexplicable. And it's almost political malfeasance, from the idea that if they are going to win Ohio this fall, John Kasich and Donald Trump need to be working very closely together. And that is definitely not where we are coming into day two of the Republican convention.
The choreography of this sort of baffles me sometimes, because you have this woman in Patricia Smith, who is a very, very powerful speaker. She's the mother of one of the four Americans killed in Benghazi. And the candidate himself goes on Bill O'Reilly at the same time that she is on the stage talking about her son. Does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't. And this is where you're just beginning to see, I think, the way that Donald Trump has run this entire campaign, where he sort of flies by the seat of his pants and anything on any day goes, that you're beginning to see just that doesn't work in the 24-hour carefully crafted news cycles of a political general election campaign, and that you need to see is you need to be sending a consistent message throughout the day. You have all of these different channels, all of these different speakers available to you, and you need to be hitting the same topic every single time you have someone out there speaking. And yesterday, you know, just on night one, there were plenty of controversies and missteps across the field for those primetime speaking hours last night that give plenty of people today cause to question the competency of the Trump political organization.
One of the things that you talked about is the fact that Donald Trump has to attract some of those Obama voters from the previous election, but Hillary Clinton needs to attract them as well, and her email controversy seems to be having an impact over her lead, according to the recent polls. Will this continue to be an issue for Clinton?
I don't think it necessarily ends up being a long-term issue for Hillary Clinton in the following very specific way. Everyone who doesn't like Hillary Clinton is going to continue talking about this. Everyone who likes Hillary Clinton saw nothing there that they didn't believe was unnecessary and unjust political persecution. And that's, I think, the fundamental challenge on so many of these Clinton controversies at this point, is that Hillary Clinton is such a polarizing binary figure that people either already like her or already don't like her. And so her challenge is, as you say, getting those Obama voters out. And in any other election cycle, I think that might prove challenging. There might be a lot of people, particularly the strong Bernie Sanders supporters, we have seen so much of here in Vermont, who might stay home in a normal election cycle. But this is anything but a normal election cycle.
When we come back, I want to turn to your piece that you did yesterday in Politico magazine. I found it actually fascinating in terms of what's going on our border with Mexico. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. If you wish to join our conversation, we're speaking with Garrett Graff, who is the former editor of Politico magazine, writes now for Politico magazine, and yesterday he wrote a piece. Well, it wasn't yesterday he wrote a piece, but it appeared in yesterday's Politico magazine called Donald Trump's Army on the Border. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Garrett, turning to your piece yesterday, the Border Patrol Union endorses Donald Trump. Why?
So the Border Patrol Union is the only national labor endorsement that Donald Trump has picked up. And they are endorsing him because of his biggest single idea, the animating force behind so much of Donald Trump's campaign, which is this idea of the wall, this massive wall that will seal our southern border, paid for, as Donald Trump likes to say, by Mexico. And the Border Patrol sees this as the Border Patrol Union, I should say, and be specific, sees this as the chance to finally take U.S. border security seriously.
What I found fascinating in reading your article is they really don't believe that a wall is going to be built, or even if it's a good idea. So why the support?
Well, as you say, what is interesting, I spent 3 days actually down at the border last week, looking at this issue on the ground in Texas, which is the hotbed of migration into the United States. And what happens down there when you get there is it turns out that since the Bush years, we have actually built 660 miles of walls and fences along the southern border. That's about a third of the U.S.-Mexico border. And effectively, at this point, we have built walls and fences everywhere that it actually makes sense to build walls or fences. And what's left is either too remote or too mountainous to really bother trying to secure. Much of Texas, of course, has the Rio Grande across the Texas-Mexico border, and that and the brushland and ranchland and farmland along the banks actually makes it pretty unnecessary to build walls and pretty difficult to build walls along most of the rest of the unfenced, unwalled Texan border.
So their endorsement, even though they don't believe that a wall is going to be built or is a good idea, is based upon the fact that Donald Trump has focused much of his campaign on border security.
And you saw this yesterday. I mean, the night one of the Republican convention was primarily about securing our border. Make America safe again is what the theme of last night was. And that this is really at a time when the world seems so fraught, where you have the terror attacks in Nice, in Turkey, in Brussels, in Paris, in San Bernardino. It really does appeal to many voters, at least in the Republican primaries thus far, who like the idea of a tough law and order candidate.
What struck me in the piece was the number of people that are still coming across the border, but they're not necessarily Mexicans.
No. So most of the migration to the southern United States border right now is what the Border Patrol calls OTMs, other than Mexicans. And it's mostly people coming from the northern triangle of Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. I was out last Monday, and I tell this story in the border story. I was out last Monday with the Border Patrol, and in 30 minutes, we stopped 37 people coming over the border from Mexico. All of them were from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And that's about par for the course down there. We're seeing about, just in this one section of the Rio Grande Valley, the Border Patrol is set to stop about 180,000 people crossing over from Mexico.
And they're well-versed on what to do once they cross the border, according to your piece.
This was actually one of the most fascinating moments of my entire experience down there, was seeing just how banal this transaction is at the moment when it actually happens. I mean, this huge, life-altering, dramatic moment, this confrontation between U.S. border guards and people crossing over illegally from Mexico, you know, there's no tension in it. The people crossing immediately whip out their birth certificates and their national identity cards because they know that it's important that their names get spelled correctly on these initial forms, and that the United States will, if they claim asylum, effectively release almost all of them into the United States within days.
One of the things that I found fascinating is that the northern border, though, is what security experts say needs attention to. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so this is not unfamiliar to many of us here in Vermont with our border with Canada, but about 90% of the Border Patrol's resources are focused on the southern border, leaving most of the Canadian border relatively unprotected and unpoliced. And when you talk to security experts, when you talk to the Border Patrol and its parent agency, Customs and Border Protection, almost all of them say that they believe that the northern border is actually much more of a threat to the United States than the southern border from a terrorism angle. Mm-hmm. And that's because Canada has its own radicalization problems. The estimates are about 300 Canadians have traveled to Syria to fight with ISIS or train with other al-Qaeda groups. And that when you look back at the history, there's actually only one border that terrorists have ever been caught sneaking over, and that is the northern border, where you have had multiple al-Qaeda-linked terrorists crossing over from Canada into the United States. This is where terrorism comes from an illegal border crossing perspective, and it's contrary to all of the rhetoric that you hear politically of ISIS camps in Mexico and ISIS sneaking over the southern border into the United States. Almost anyone that you talk to will actually say they're worried about the northern border.
We got about 2 minutes left. What has our efforts over the years taught us about stemming the flow of people trying to illegally cross our southern border?
Well, we've gotten a lot better than we used to. We have poured about $100 billion into border security and immigration enforcement since 9/11. And that has bought a lot of border guards, bought a lot of walls, a lot of fences, and a lot of very good surveillance and technology. And what we need more of today, according to the people that I spoke with, is more of that technology, and that we actually have a pretty good ability to catch the people that we know are crossing the border. But what the CBP and Border Patrol are concerned about is whether we are actually seeing all of the people who are crossing over the border right now.
And we got about 30 seconds left, maybe 45. One of the things that I found fascinating in your article, the union for its deadliest law enforcement agency. Why is it the deadliest law enforcement agency?
The Border Patrol has been involved, and this is in the midst of, again, all of this Black Lives Matter and use of force, police militarization questions. The Border Patrol has been involved in nearly 50 use of force deaths, lethal contacts with people along the border. And that has raised a lot of questions about the training that the Border Patrol has to use lethal force along a very perilous and high-risk area.
Garrett Graff, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That is Garrett Graff, who is the former editor of Politico magazine. And our topic today we were discussing with him was the Republican Convention and his piece in Politico magazine yesterday on U.S. Border Patrol. I urge you to go read it. It's actually a really fascinating piece. I want to thank our guests today. Jace LeCair, the 17-year-old who is a Vermont delegate to the Republican National Convention. Very, very articulate young man. Jeff Bartley, who is the executive director of the Vermont GOP. Steve Terry, who's WCAX political analyst. And, of course, just heard Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. Mostly our concentration today was talking about the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. And, of course, I want to thank all of you. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary. This year, we are celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls, and have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.